CD 8.
Back in Ankh-Morpork, Mr. Cleet was astonished.
"But we hired you," he said.
"The term is retained, not hired," said Lord Downey, head of the Assassin's Guild. He looked at Cleet with an expression of unconcealed distaste.
"Unfortunately, however, we can no longer entertain your contract."
"They're musicians," said Mr. Cleet. "How hard can they be to kill?"
"My associates are somewhat reluctant to talk about it," said Lord Downey. "They seem to feel that the clients are protected in some way. Obviously, we will return the balance of your fee."
"Protected?"
muttered Cleet, as they stepped thankfully through the archway of the Assassin's Guild.
"Well, I told you what it was like in the drum when..." Satchel Mouth began.
"That's just superstition," snapped Cleet.
He glanced up at a wall where three festival posters flaunted their primary colours.
"It was stupid of you to think assassins would be any good outside the city,"
muttered Cleet.
"Me? I never..."
"Get them more than 5 miles from a decent tailor and a mirror, and they all go to pieces,"
Cleet added. He stared at the poster.
"Free," he muttered. "Did you put it about that anyone who plays at this festival is right out of the guild?"
Yes, sir. I don't think they're worrying, sir. I mean, some of them have been getting together, sir. See, they say since there's a lot more people want to be musicians than we'll allow in the guild, then we should..."
"It's mob rule," said Cleet. "Banding together to force unacceptable rules on a defenceless city."
"Trouble is, sir," said Satchel Mouth, "if there's a lot of them, if they think of talking to the palace, well, you know the patrician, sir."
Cleet nodded glumly. Any guild was powerful just so long as it self-evidently spoke for its constituency. He thought of hundreds of musicians flocking to the palace, hundreds of non-guild musicians. The patrician was a pragmatist. He never tried to fix things that worked. Things that didn't work, however, got broken. The only glimmer of hope was that they'd all be too busy messing around with music to think about the bigger picture. It had certainly worked for Cleet. Then he remembered that the blasted Dibbler man was involved. Expecting Dibbler not to think about anything concerning money was like expecting rocks not to think about gravity.
"Hello? Albert?"
Susan pushed open the kitchen door. The huge room was empty.
"Albert!"
She tried upstairs. There was her own room, and there was a corridor of doors that didn't open and possibly never could. The doors and frames had an all-in-one moulded-together look. Presumably Death had a bedroom, although proverbially Death never slept. Perhaps he just lay in bed reading. She tried the handles until she found one that turned. Death did have a bedroom. He'd got many of the details right, of course. After all, he saw quite a lot of bedrooms. In the middle of the acres of floor was a large four-poster bed, although when Susan gave it an experimental prod, it turned out that the sheets were as solid as rock. There was a full-length mirror and a wardrobe. She had a look inside just in case there was a selection of robes, but there was nothing in there except a few old shoes in the bottom. Old shoes always turn up in the bottom of every wardrobe. If a mermaid had a wardrobe, old shoes would turn up in the bottom of it. A dressing table held a jug and basin set with a motif of skulls and omegas and a variety of bottles and other items. She picked them up one by one. Aftershave lotion, pomade, breath freshener, a pair of silver-backed hairbrushes. It was all rather sad. Death clearly had picked up an idea of what a gentleman should have on his dressing room table without confronting one or two fundamental questions. Eventually, she found a smaller, narrower staircase.
"Albert?"
There was a door at the top.
"Albert? Anyone?"
"It's not actually barging in if I call out first," she told herself. She pushed open the door. It was a very small room, really small. It contained a few sticks of bedroom furniture and a small, narrow bed. A small bookcase contained a handful of small, uninteresting-looking books. There was a piece of ancient paper on the floor, which, when Susan picked it up, turned out to be covered with numbers, all crossed out except the last one, which was 19. One of the books was Gardening in Difficult Conditions. She went back down to the study. She'd known that there was no one in the house. There was a dead feeling in the air. There was the same feeling in the gardens. Death could create most things, except for plumbing, but he couldn't create life itself.